All right. Thank you, Deshaun. And that was a great interview with a Libertarian candidate for the 3rd Congressional District here in Central Ohio. Now we're going to jump right into Labor Creates All Wealth, a program here on WCRS that deals with issues related to the work place, you know, the work life, and society in general. Let's face it. I mean, if you have a situation where your work doesn't provide you with the remuneration that you need to live and sustain your family, labor creates all wealth, and we need to get our piece of that, so to speak. Today we've got a great interview with a individual that has spent his entire life, or nearly his entire life, on social and political activism. He's an author, a politician, who's a director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, California. He's known best for his major role in the anti-war movement, civil rights, and peace activism. He's the co-founder of the Students for Democratic Society, which happened in circa 1962. Welcome, Tom Hayden. Welcome to Labor Creates All Wealth.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Kurt.
Well, thanks for granting this interview. I know that you're an awfully busy man. You're working across the country doing speeches nearly, looks like your schedule's nearly every other day, it seems like. I'll be with Tom tomorrow in Springfield, Illinois, where he'll be presenting at the University of Illinois there. Tom, tell us a little bit about the founding of the Students for Democratic Society and the history of the Port Huron Statement, which was sort of, you know, the founding document of that organization.
Well, if you want to go back, fine. I hope we can also talk about the crisis in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Oh, sure.
Presidential election, but you know, it's not true that I've spent my entire adult life in activism. I have only spent 50 or 52 straight years. Before that, I used to hitchhike down to Ohio from Ann Arbor and watch University of Michigan, Ohio State football games, which is to say that I come from the lower middle class of the heartland of the Midwest, and I spent at least 20 years of my life in that zone of the country, and I miss it very much.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. You know, at the time, you know, back in 1962, doing a little bit of the math from your bio, you were just, what, 23, 24 years old when this all got started and you guys drafted this monumental statement.
A little younger than that, but more or less, yes.
Yeah, right about that. So, what, were you like a junior in college, or...?
No, I was out. I mean, just I think it's just just like the best mathematicians are young people. So are you know, the best rebels. I think it's because generationally there's a moment, you know, when I didn't know what my future would be, like millions of other young people, and all I knew was that the future prepared for me by my parents' generation was really unsettling. I would not settle for it. It was too unsettling. And that's when creativity, I think, sparks off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the document, which I haven't read in its entirety, is very, very detailed, and you guys really put a lot of work into that. What are some of the main concepts that came out of the Huron Statement that you'd like to, you know, carry forward into the modern times? I mean, let's face it, all of the things that were happening then are happening now, kind of. Right.
Not really, but we can get to that. This is the 50th year of its being... And hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And 50 is a big round number, and journalists like to, you know, dwell on the 50th anniversary, the 50th year, the meaning of it. And so it was my thought and a few other friends to spend the year trying to speak, write, organize conferences, a dozen or more around the country, on its significance today and, you know, where we came from.
Right.
I think the principal concept was participatory democracy, which is more than electing representatives, but
also
not the same as opposing electoral politics or opposing voting. It's more the idea that social movements like the civil rights and students movements that we came out of are kind of a triggering mechanism, a wake-up, a shock to the system that sometimes can create space for political victories, for the passage of laws like the Voting Rights Act and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that was that's the enduring idea. The document itself is 25,000 words long, so Kurt, I can forgive you for not finishing it, but try to do it before tomorrow.
Yeah, there'll be an assignment, right?
Yeah. Tomorrow is Springfield, right?
That's right, yeah. I'll be registering college kids out front while you'll be educating them inside. So
Kent State, you spoke of, is the 30th of October, am I right?
Yes, it is, and you'll be speaking at the May 4th Visitors Center.
Yeah. Ohio, Illinois roadmap that I have before me here.
Yeah. What's great about this, and I think fabulous about this, is that you're passing sort of all of this on to, you know, kids that are sort of at that stage in their life through this speaking tour. Are most of your dates on college campuses?
College campuses, community centers, bookstores, to reach the younger generation takes a lot of organizing, because nobody's walking around asking for Port Huron statements anymore, but there is a desire to compare experiences between the older and younger generations. There is a spirit of participatory democracy very, very much alive in the Occupy movement, in the the Dream Act students movement,
sure.
LGBT recent victories for marriage equality and access to the military, and they all involve the same thing. Sort of out of nowhere, frustrated group of people decides that nobody's listening, and so they've got to take the microphone. They've got to speak up. They've got to speak out. And if they're successful in reaching enough others, including people in the institutional realm of power, they will make make progress. And I don't know of another way. It's not a theory. It's actually an experience.
Yeah.
That I'm describing. It doesn't come from any ism.
Right.
The idea comes, I suppose, from the whole history of grassroots movements and participatory movements from outside the system. It has spokespeople like Henry David Thoreau, John Dewey, but basically it's the way things have gotten done, not only in America, but often around the world.
Right, right. And, you know, I came to, learn more about you, obviously, through my activism with the Progressive Democrats of America, which is an organization that kind of is working between elections as much as it is on elections. The organization around issues as opposed to politicians. And I want to thank you for your advisory role in that organization. I know that you're on the advisory board, and you sort of steer the leaders that I work with. So that's
a pleasure.
Yeah.
Glad they're there. They're doing a good job.
Well, I don't know if you saw any of the video from our alternate convention down in Charlotte, but we had a really good time down there, and we got 60 or 70 of the Democratic National Convention delegates to come out to our event on the Tuesday after Labor Day. And part of what they took back to the convention was Robin Hood hats for the financial transactions tax. So, you know, we got our message inside the hall.
I got one myself right in my car on the seat.
Awesome. That's
talking
great.
Talking about a tax on Wall Street financial transactions.
Yep.
With the revenue to go to health care, for the nurses, education, social programs.
Absolutely.
Et cetera. And, you know, it's interesting if you read and talk to enough people as I do. There was a time only a year or two ago that President Obama endorsed the idea in the White House, and it was blocked by the very economic advisors that he had chosen. So I think keeping up the drumbeat for a Robin Hood tax is one of these issues that progressive Democrats need to put on the agenda, along with the National Nurses United and you know, many other people, some of the Occupy Wall Street people. It's a good issue, and you know, in this world, we only gain ground inch by inch. I think of that as sacred ground. Other people think of it as gradualism.
Right. Yeah, well, we've heard the, I came sort of to PDA out of the healthcare issue. I was a state activist for a state healthcare initiative. And, you know, in that field, they talk about folks who are incrementalists. But quite frankly, you've got to get some of that stuff done slowly. But you've got to keep on. The Affordable Care Act was one thing, but we cannot rest. You know, it's not going to solve the problem.
It's a derogatory term, incrementalist.
Right.
I would say radical reform is what we want. Look, the proof is in history, it's not in theory. No matter how urgent you are, no matter how passionate you are, no matter how much in a hurry you are, history shows that you gain ground inch by inch. Sometimes it's surprising. It comes unexpectedly, too.
Mm-hmm.
But
fits and starts.
That's just the way it is. No, I mean, when you gain ground, a counter-movement is very threatened, and they arise, and they become semi-hysterical and even more organized than your movement, and that's what's threatening the country right now with the Tea Party as the personification of that phenomenon.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what do you think the future holds for sort of the radical rightists that we've seen in the Tea Party movement? Do you think that's waning now, or do you think they're still, you know?
Temporarily, yeah. We underestimated the radical right at Port Huron. We saw the world as kind of the center, the liberals, and we were the new left.
Mm-hmm.
And the far right was the disappearing faction of white Southern segregationists who we were driving out of the Democratic Party.
Right.
We didn't think beyond that. Well, there was also the crazy people that wanted to drop nuclear bombs on Russia, like Curtis LeMay.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that we were entering a new era where those ideas of dropping the nuclear bomb and maintaining segregation were so unpopular, so irrational, so outmoded that we could really consider pushing on the center to make it more progressive. But what happened that reinforced our view but started the Tea Party was the defeat of Senator Goldwater in 1964, who represented that element. He was crushed. So we thought, well, too bad, good riddance, move forward. But out of the Goldwater campaign, it strengthened Young Americans for Freedom. The John Birch Society kind of shed its image. And you can see down through the present moment that a lot of the activists and organizers shaping the Tea Party come out of that.
They're sort of the new John Birch Society, kind of.
they're still around, and I think we underestimated that. So in my new revised proposal for consideration of how things work, is that when you win, you also provoke a great danger from a counter-movement, because your people relax with victory, and their people are sincere, and unfortunately they feel that their world is ending, so they come back harder. They
right.
can come back with violence, they can come back with political campaigns, with lawsuits, big money to hire big lobbyists, the works.
Right, right. Well, and you know, they've been funded in large part by these large, you know, wealthy industrialists who come out of that tradition, right? I mean, you know, I know the Koch brothers' name has been bandied about, but their father was one of those John Birch founders, right? Or
yes, and also they have a distorted reading of the Gospel of Ayn Rand. I think everybody needs to go quickly to their bookstore and read the history of this strange person, author of Atlas Shrugged and so
right.
on. And whole generation of the Paul Ryans
mm-hmm.
grew up on this idea, you know, that the state was composed of people who were taking, and not doing their individual work ethic, and
sure.
goes all the way down to Romney's comments about the 47%. So
mm-hmm.
they do have a gospel, they have a high priestess, they have a lot of money, but I think it's also important for us to remember that if it was not for the assassinations of the 60s, our side would have won.
Mm-hmm.
We still have the numbers. If you take the the preference of all voters, President Obama's ahead by 15, 20, 25 points.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a battle over the likely voters, and that's what you see going on intensely
right.
in places like Ohio, where every means that can be used to diminish the black vote, the student vote, and so on, will be used, and it's not over, but it's still it's looking pretty good for the Obama coalition, and I think that's partly because of the demographics of the country
right.
have continued to change.
More diversity and
yeah, know, making yeah. it very hard for a kind of all-white male, you know, political party to get traction,
right?
Even if they add a token Herman Cain or somebody like that to their profile.
Well, and it seems so interesting that they're so blatantly open about their contempt for, you know, the other, whoever that is. It seems openly, and I don't know how they, you know, in the world of politics, how do they build a coalition that's going to be, you know, able to capture the White House if they keep cutting away portions of the population?
Well, to their credit, they're true believers.
Mm-hmm.
They want to go down fighting for their flag. People like Karl Rove may be a little more cynically pragmatic and be trying to encourage them to reach out to this group or that group. But hardcore, I mean, I'm from the same background as Paul Ryan, small town Wisconsin Roman Catholic. His spine is strong. Now, he will make compromises, of course, because he's in Congress, but he's on a path. He's on a journey. A lot of liberals don't know what journey they're on. They just want things to make sense, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But Paul Ryan has an ideological fervor that goes back to this doctrine of the individual man astride the free market and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to make a compromise that would allow them to get 50-60% traction with the American people anytime soon. That means they have to buy elections
mm-hmm.
or steal elections.
And suppress the vote in any way
suppress
they can.
Suppress the vote, make it harder to vote, and pour money in, including, as a few people are aware, secret money. Now we have secret millions of dollars going into these campaigns.
Yeah.
And the fact that Obama is still ahead testifies to something.
Well, I think partly it testifies to the sort of we're in this together empathy of the broader populace. You know, I mean, everybody sees that we're not individual sort of actors on our own that can simply say, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and I'm going to have everything that I need because I'm smart and people like me, you know, all those kind of things. They have to cooperate and collaborate with their fellow citizens in order to have a successful society, you know? I think where there's a lot of people are, you know, it's kind of...
I saw in the recent polling, and I watched these things very carefully, that Obama was pulling ahead, and on most of the categories he had more favorable polling than Romney. But when the same people, the American voters, were asked, which do you prefer, strong individual responsibility or shared responsibility, the majority was for strong individual responsibility. So,
That's our Puritan background, I guess.
No, I'm from that background. I didn't get any favors in life, and there is something heroic and romantic about, you know, the individual standing up. We believe that when we see them standing up for a cause, but liberals tend to disbelieve it when they talk about how businesses get started. So I think there's a gradual shift, and we shouldn't underestimate the degree to which people still
cling to
have
that.
I think it's based on the frontier, you know, this...
Sure.
It's violent and blood-curdling towards the Native Americans, and at the same time, in the name of the yeoman farmer or the individualist.
Right, conquering the new territory, so to speak.
Yeah, I know. If you look at other capitalist countries, like France or even Britain or Germany, countries that went through the horrors of World War II and lost tens of millions of people, they have much more of an ethic of commonality and shared responsibility from their experience. The American frontier experience, I think, leaves a residue of stronger individualism. We have to deal with that.
Right. Well, and yeah, even though they were out there on the frontier, though, when they had to raise a house, they did it together, right? I mean, not everybody
with their little clique.
Right. So, anyway.
Surrounded by the dangerous old Indians.
The ones that were left that we hadn't diseased, right?
The buffalo herds that hadn't been killed off. I mean, it's not something that I'm defending. I'm
sure.
Simply describing how this mythology has more of a place
here
in American culture than in some other countries.
Well, let's move on.
I think people also think Obama's victory is a triumph of the collective struggle for civil rights, but I think they also see him as a distinct individual, very smart, very strong, etc. He's within both narratives, the narrative of the collective history
and the
narrative of the individual that goes far because of their own talents and so on.
Right. Let's move on now to what you mentioned earlier, some of the current topics that you're thinking about, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. What was it that you wanted to say about that earlier?
Well, I don't think the election is going to be settled on these issues, but it's very dangerous what's happening. And my own view of the way history works is that when social movements succeed, as I said, there's a counter movement, and then there's a huge battle over memory. You know, we pretty much won the debate in American society to get out and stay out of Iraq. But there's always a lobby to go back in, to say it's not over, to blame Obama for not winning an unwinnable war, and to crank it up again. This week it was just revealed that contrary to the withdrawal agreement, there are active units of American special forces on the ground in Iraq.
Still operating,
Yeah, so the battle for memory is very important. For instance, when the Chinese Revolution happened, the United States was on the losing side of the Civil War.
Right. In the middle of the 20th century, yeah.
Yeah, rather than accept the Chinese Communist government, spent 50 to 70 years in a Cold War against them, which was only ended by Nixon and Kissinger for strategic reasons. But along the way, who lost China was the mantra, the question raised by right-wing Republicans, and they formed something called the China Lobby, and they succeeded in creating, McCarthyism as an anti-communist witch hunt.
Sure. The red scare and red baiting of politicians, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so you know, to Obama's credit, I think he's smart enough to know, but never say, that he's getting out of a couple of wars as best he can, knowing that we did not win them, could not win them, and he doesn't want to spill more blood or pour good money after bad, but he can't say it. He wants it to appear to be a successful exit, right?
Victory with honor.
That's where Obama, the individualist, doesn't have all the cards. He can't dictate what happens. Fortunately, I think the American people are sick to death of these wars, want to save lives, want to save trillions of dollars for domestic programs, do not want to go back in. But you're hearing it now, starting up about Iraq. You'll hear it about Afghanistan soon enough. And above all, because it's election time, you'll hear it about supporting Israel in a war against Iran.
Mm-hmm. Well, his statements at the UN seem to be pretty measured in that regard.
I don't trust any statements. This thing is getting closer. Netanyahu wants something to happen. Romney will do anything that the Likud party tells him to do. The neocons are just crazy for overthrowing Iran. And Obama is trying to navigate without being absolutely clear about where he's going. And I think the first step is to get through the damned election.
Yeah.
but then, what's on Obama's
what's on the other table? Side? Right, exactly.
The deficit crisis comes back. Tax cuts for the rich, to cut or not to cut Medicare, and prime time for a war with Iran. So it's like, let's take it by stages here. Let's get through the election conceptually. Then, what are progressive Democrats and
We've got to move on a prosperity agenda, not an austerity agenda. I'm sick of the phrase shared sacrifice. Let's have some shared prosperity instead.
You could try that. I mean, I would offer this, that it all depends on the strength of social movements on the outside, but in terms of getting some tasks, some missions completed in Obama's next term, assuming that he wins, we need to convince him that it's part of his legacy. In other words, he's made history, but he hasn't left a legacy. Want to. So if we can say, for instance, go back to your student days at Columbia University, part of the nuclear freeze when you wrote about the bomb. Now, tell us how you'll make historic legacy in your second term about nuclear weapons. I could go down a list, but you get the idea.
Yeah. Well, like FDR told organized labor and A. Philip Randolph and all those folks, make me. We've got to make him, right? Outside of his sphere of influence and sort of inside by keeping alive that participatory democracy.
They say he said that, but that's true.
Yeah.
With John Kennedy and the nuclear test ban treaty, FDR and the Wagner Act, Social Security, Abraham Lincoln, emancipation,
proclamation,
Civil War.
Exactly. Well, we've got to wrap this up. We're down to our last minute. I wanted to just tell our listeners one more time, you know, on October 30th, you can see this great man speak again at the May 4th Visitor Center on the campus of the Kent State University. Again, that's October the 30th. Kent State University has all the details. Mr. Hayden, thank you very much for the interview.
Bert, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and I hope that we get some time tomorrow evening to sit down and have a discussion as well. All right.
Okay.
Thank you. This has been WCRS Radio. Labor creates all wealth.